Okay, our at-ease is over. Our technical difficulties have been fixed. So today, we only have one bill on our agenda. That's House Bill 25, Healthcare Service Directives, sponsored by Representative Wyrock. And what I'd like to do, they have been working on this bill quite extensively, and we now would like to deal with the current version. And so I move that we bring CS House Bill 25, version 23-LS0137/H before the committee for discussion. So without any objections, we now have the committee substitute for House Bill 25-H before us. So who is going to fill us in on this?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Linda Sylvester, and I'm a legislative aide for Representative Wyrock, who should be here, but is across the street, I believe. So what we've prepared for you is a version of House Bill 25 that is practically perfect.
That will be seen.
Linda, why don't you just go and tell us what changes you made since the last time we heard this bill?
Okay. What we have done this since the last time is we've incorporated all the mental health issues into this version. We do not resuscitate statutes. We're already there. The living will, everything was fine, but we needed to do a clean sweep and make sure that the mental health issues were all represented in this bill, as well as the anatomical gift donations. And we worked real closely with Life Alaska, which is essentially the clearinghouse for organ donations in the state of Alaska. Jens Sakvitny, and Mr. Sakvitny should be online to answer questions on this. Before we go any further, I want to explain who's in the audience today. It's kind of exciting. The Alaska Mental Health Board is meeting in Juneau, and members of the board from out of town are here. I wanted to introduce Edie Zukoskis, who has been terribly involved in this and from the very beginning when we started working on this, and she is superb. And if you have any questions regarding mental health, Edie, as well as Richard Greenery from the Mental Health Board, and other board members are out in the hallway someplace. And then we also have from Comfort One, Shelley Owens, who can answer any of the do not resuscitate issues. Representative Sisna's office has a couple amendments, I believe, that we want to consider, and that they deal with the do not resuscitate orders, and Andy Josephson, Representative Sisna's aide, will explain those, and we can hash that out. And I think that's, aside from members of the AARP and hospice, and then also online we have, I feel like an MC, also online we have Dr. Maria Wallington, who's the medical ethicist from Providence Hospital, to answer any questions. She's totally familiar with the concept and very supportive of this, and she has complete understanding of how this works in the real world.
Okay.
Hey.
Do any of the committee members have any questions? Representative Gotti.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very arriving. Coming, Mary.
Representative Kapsner has just joined us.
We talked a short while ago about surrogates.
Surrogates.
And in that conversation, did you tell me essentially that that had been taken care of, wrapped up, or we were working on it?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, at the last meeting, we gave a blanket exemption to surrogates. Surrogates would be left out of. And we revisited that, and what we've done, and Edie can come to the table if you would like.
Sure.
Edie.
what we have done, in a conversation with Dr. Wallington and Edie and myself, we exempted surrogates from mental health care treatment. So if you have mental health issues, you can make a directive for your health care issues, for your general health care issues, but you're precluded from making a surrogate.
What we want to be able to do is include individuals with mental.
Excuse me, would you tell your name and your affiliation?
Mm-hmm. Edie Zapkowskis. I'm a mental health attorney with the Disability Law Center.
Can I ask a question before you start?
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. You may
Chair.
Ask a question.
Surrogate. You know, I've heard the term, oh, she's a surrogate mother. There seems to be a very strong connection in the word surrogate with the person that they're surrogating. What is the legal definition of a surrogate with regard to this bill?
There's probably more than one, depending on the context in which it's used. Now, our concerns with the surrogate as it is in this bill is that the mental health community had never before been involved with surrogates. Because of their particular issues, frequently their goals or values differ from that of their families and their friends. So what we would like to accomplish with this particular bill and in this particular section is that the mental health community is still able to partake in the benefits of the bill, but that a surrogate not be appointed in the event it's a mental health issue. And if I may just confirm that with Richard, because Richard was the one that sort of glommed onto that. We at the Disability Law Center don't think it's a major issue here yet, but we do feel we need input from the consumers, because there's a history here that I'm not familiar with. Richard probably is familiar with, and we think it's just one of those issues that it's imperative we get consumer input on. However, we also feel we can deal with that in judiciary. So
I think that probably would be the because those are so technical. So that's kind of a decision that I would like to make. There is Bob Briggs from the Disability Law Center wasn't able to meet with us today, and they're still working on a definition of mental health treatment. And we'll leave that for when he comes and when it's in judiciary. So that little aspect of it will take care of then.
I'm still looking for the definition.
I wouldn't be able to give you a legal definition because,
give me another legal one.
Well, I think it probably differs depending on the context. I don't know.
A general one, then.
Pardon me? I think it's someone who acts in the place of another when that person is unable to speak for themselves. Sort of, does that give you any idea?
That's where I was.
Okay.
But we have a bill here.
Yeah. What page, Linda?
On page 30, through the chair, Representative Gatto, on page 30 of version H, line 9. Surrogate means an individual other than a patient's agent or guardian authorized under this chapter to make a health care decision for the patient. And practically speaking, the bill, HB 25, lays out the hierarchy of individuals in their order of who might be a surrogate, who might not be. It's if you're married, your wife would be probably the first person that a medical personnel would choose to be a surrogate, or your adult child, and if you're traveling. If you're traveling with a friend, that person would be available and would be called upon to act in your best interest. And of course, practically speaking, they would make contacts with other people who are closer in their relationship with you. But they would take steps to act in your behalf if somebody else, like your agent or your power of attorney, wasn't reasonably available.
Any other questions by the committee? Representative Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last meeting, trying to find it so I could refer specifically to it, but Pam was talking about situational depression and that how do we get a diagnosis. I think the doctor was talking about this. Did we clarify that in this new draft?
We did. Dr. Wellington?
Yes, I'm here. I felt comfortable with limiting the exclusion of surrogates to only those issues that are surrounding the treatment of mental illness. My concern was that someone who had other medical issues trying to be decided would be left with no one to decide for them if we limited surrogates. And I was comfortable with just excluding them in those situations where the mental illness treatment is the issue at hand.
Dr. Wellington, would you give your affiliation for us, please?
All right, I'm the ethicist for the Providence Health System in Alaska.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hines?
Thank you. Dr. Wellington, I think what I'm specifically more referring to is I believe you were concerned that if you didn't know that someone had been treated for, say, situational depression, that you might be unaware of that?
Actually, it was the opposite. If somebody had been treated for situational depression, and yet what had happened is they'd had a stroke and now they couldn't speak for themselves and we had to decide about their long-term treatment, that because we had a mental health illness diagnosis on the chart, we would be excluded from using the surrogate process to help decide whether they should be going to a long-term care facility or where they could go home or other issues that didn't have to do with treatment of a mental illness.
Okay, so Dr. Wellington, now the way this H version of the committee substitute is set up, are you feel more comfortable about that?
I'm happy with it, yes.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Questions of?
Of anyone. Representative Seaton?
Yes. I don't see it right now. It came kind of late. That do not resuscitate orders. We had a question from the nurse about whether we have hospital policies that would be in violation of this. Has that been cleared up, and can you point me to the section?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, explain it with an analogy. In Alaska, there's no law prohibiting a doctor from treating someone who's a minor, but other things take precedence for a hospital. For example, being authorized for payment or being sued, liability issues. So they seek parental authorization.
Excuse me. Are we talking about the do not resuscitate order here? Okay.
So in this situation, let me keep my thought here. In this situation, the statute authorizes the do not resuscitate protocol. A hospital might have their own policies, and they might those decisions might be driven by other things besides the statutes. They might be driven by liability concerns. So the hospital could have policies that are more restrictive than what the statute would allow. For example, in this statute, you can't force a physician to treat somebody in a particular way. They have a mechanism to opt out if it violates their hospital's policy on, for example, if you have a, this is again an analogy not associated with our bill. If you are, you wouldn't expect a hospital that's run by the Catholic Church to provide abortions on demand. And state law authorizes abortion clearly, but we don't force the hospital to treat or do that particular procedure. And Dr. Wellington would also be
on that point.
Representative Gatto, you were next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just this question, I kind of like this point of do not resuscitate. If we have an order for do not resuscitate, but a hospital has a policy of resuscitating, can the surrogate, does the surrogate have any authority then within the hospital setting to overrule the hospital as long as they had the documents.
We have Shelley Owens, who is...
Well, I'm sorry, I'm the health program manager with Community Health and Emergency Medical Services in the Division of Public Health, Community Health Department. The first question, I think, was about the oral do not resuscitate order, which Mark Johnson, the section chief, spoke to at the last hearing, and talked about the compelling reason to have the ability to authorize, for a physician to authorize an oral do not resuscitate order. For communities that don't have a resident physician, for EMTs to be able to receive a verbal do not resuscitate from the medical director, from the primary physician over the phone. I guess it would be the primary physician over the phone. So the oral do not resuscitate order is in the existing law. It's not a change. Our primary goal is to ensure that the Comfort One program remains intact as this bill passes through. So I understand the Bartlett nurses' concern that they may be in a conflict position where a physician is in the community and could come into the hospital and write a do not resuscitate order. But to change that and remove the ability to issue an oral do not resuscitate order, I think would be pretty problematic for Bush communities and for EMTs. And as Linda Sylvester was saying, that the hospital may be able to have to be more restrictive. I don't know that Bartlett has ever run into a problem with this. She didn't mention it.
Yeah.
The fact that this has been the existing law has created a hardship for them or for their patients. And I'm sorry, Representative Gatto, through the chair. It sounded like you had a second question about the ability of a hospital to not want to honor a do not resuscitate order.
Representative Gatto. Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was collating the thing between the surrogate, the do not resuscitate order, the hospital's policy, and saying now we're in a setting where we have a do not resuscitate order, we have a document, and we have a policy that conflicts with it. I don't know what happens at that point.
I think the bill is provides that when there is a conflict, that the healthcare provider does not want to honor, for reasons of conscience, a particular healthcare directive, that'll be communicated, and the patient will be transferred to another facility or another healthcare provider. I'm not certain where that is. I think there's an. Page 7. Does that answer your question?
Actually not. I was thinking in the situation where a do not resuscitate order was needed right now because of a crisis. Mm-hmm. Not that a person was in the hospital with a DNR order and we could then transfer them to another hospital because we had 6 months to go and we just wanted to leave it that way. But rather at that moment, when it's time to exercise that decision, is that something that is covered in a statute where we're going to have this conflict of saying, our policy says I have to resuscitate, and you're giving me a DNR order at this moment? What does the hospital do?
You just said it wasn't in that house. You weren't in the hospital.
No, I'm saying at the moment when we have the crisis.
Well, that... I'd like to make a comment here. That's why we want to get this in place, so that what normally would happen is the minute somebody hits the doors of the hospital, those questions are asked. Even in an emergency room, you would like to be able to ask those questions so that you know how to deal with it, so that the staff and everybody knows how to. If that comes up, what are we going to do? So
exactly it. If I wheel in Dad, and I'm running with the gurney, with the ambulance, and I say, we have a DNR order for my dad here, and they say, sorry, sir, but we have a hospital policy.
No,
I'll say, I have a DNR order. No, we have a hospital policy.
No, okay, Representative Gatto, through the chair, that on page 7 of the draft, it provides that a healthcare provider may decline to comply with an individual instruction or healthcare decision for reasons of conscience, except for a do not resuscitate order. And just to clarify, the Comfort One program is designed for the pre-hospital environment. It's for patients that are at home that want to, that are not within, and hospital DNRs can tend to be more specific with specific medications and other types of measures that may be taken. But for an EMT out in the bush or, you know, and volunteers, it's pretty much a binary system. If a person has do not resuscitate identification, then they don't resuscitate. They don't have the time, as you know, to make decisions or make discretionary decisions. So we wanted to keep it as clear and simple as possible. That's why that provision says, except for do not resuscitate order. So there isn't this confusion on scene where there's conflict between EMTs about whether to resuscitate or not resuscitate.
I've served on an ambulance squad in a rural, very rural area, and the majority of them, if they know something, the EMTs really stay on top of this, and if they know that there's somebody that's ill, especially if they're close to being terminally ill, they make sure that, and everybody in the community kind of knows, if you go to the clinic lets the ambulance crew know that which ones have DNR. Orders so that if they have to go to that home or something, that they actually have them lots of times with them, and have which ones have DNR orders. So in the small communities, they really try to stay on top of this. Of course, there's incidences when people don't have it because it's an accident or something. But when it's a terminal patient, they usually know ahead of time. They work together very good at this. Representative Seaton?
Yes, thank you. I guess I'm a little confused because I'm remembering testimony that we had at our last hearing in which the nurse was afraid that she was going to be in conflict because the hospital had a policy that the statute was going to require the nurse to do something that was against the hospital policy. And it seems that on page 8D, we still have that, where a healthcare provider shall comply with the protocol under B of this section or do not resuscitate. Now, that's not a problem unless the hospital has policy. Now, are there hospitals in Alaska that do not resuscitate orders?
An oral do not resuscitate order or do not resuscitate order?
This says here an oral order or a written one. It says either oral or written in D. And that's the question.
And so I just from my experience, if a hospital has, if it states in their regulations or whatever that it has to be a written order, then they will want it to be a written order. And lots of times a nurse will, if they have a patient in there, they'll even remind the doctor, you haven't written that order down, and that's got to be written down. And if a nurse, if a doctor just, and she was talking about if she called in, called the doctor, and the doctor said, well, just do this, and I'll come in later. And she has the right to say, no, our orders are this, and you have to come in, and he'd have to come in and write it. I mean, he really would.
Okay,
that was the conflict she was talking about.
Yeah, that was the conflict in which there was an oral, but she's required under the statute. Mm-hmm.
Under the hospital.
Yeah, and that.
But the hospital will not let her follow the statute without being in violation of their policy.
Yeah. And
because this says oral as well.
But I don't think we can fix that. That's a hospital part of it. We can't fix that here because this is between. What's going on at the hospital level?
Madam Chair, this is Dr. Wallington.
Yes.
I'm wondering whether I'm looking at the same place you are, because I have a D version rather than an H version. But under Do Not Resuscitate Protocol and Identification Requirements, Section D, I think this is trying to say that the healthcare providers must when there is indeed an order for do not resuscitate. So if that order comes through Comfort 1, which is Section B under this thing, or it comes as an oral, or it comes as a written, healthcare provider must comply. I don't think it's addressing how that order gets actuated. That is, whether the hospital says it has to be written or not. I don't think it's addressing that. I think it's addressing the action of the providers.
Madam Chair.
Am I clear?
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, and that's exactly my point, is that this requires that the nurse comply with the oral do not resuscitate order.
Correct. If it's allowed and she has it, then she has to comply.
See.
So is there something we need in here at all, that if the institution allows oral, I mean, because we are requiring the healthcare provider here to comply with this statute, and we don't have the exception of an oral if allowed by the institution.
This is saying, this right here says if we've got the order, you know, it's in our hand.
Or if there's an oral order. This says oral right here.
But that's under a different.
It's recognizing that an oral order may be acceptable. I don't think it's saying that an oral order has to be accepted.
Okay.
I want to just point out to you that this chapter is similar to what's in the current law, saying that the department, Department of Education, will adopt regulations or protocol that have to do with DNR orders, and that policy which they've adopted refers to the Comfort One, which is the out-of-hospital. And it's my understanding that hospitals recognize the Comfort One order as a valid order which they continue to honor when the patient is in the hospital. I think that's addressing what Dr. Gough, Representative Gatto, was asking. I'm not sure.
This refers you up to B. You know, D refers you up to B. Does anybody have any other questions? Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify further, or anyone online that would like to testify further? Yes. Please come forward and state your name and affiliation.
For the record, my name is Bob Taylor, and I'm the acting director of the Alaska Commission on Aging. And I just wanted to take a few seconds of your time to underline how important this bill is to the commission. I haven't had a chance to read the most up-to-date version, and I know you're already dealing in really technical issues, and I appreciate that. I guess I just wanted to get back to the overarching theme of your work, which is a really important effort that you're doing here to make things clearer and easier for the families of elders and of the elderly themselves in making these important decisions. I was thumbing through a public policy report from the National Academy on Aging Society, a policy institute of the Gerontological Society of America, and they go into great length about what they call the balkanization of internal state law, and how many states are doing just what you're doing here today and taking these laws that are fragmented and here and there and everywhere in the statutes and bringing them together into one place, and how important that is. You're still on the cutting edge of this. This is a 2003 report, and only 16 states have managed to pull everything together into a comprehensive package that does make everything clear to the public and to healthcare providers of how this all can work. And just one other thing that I see in this bill that's, I think, important is an issue that they call comity, and C-O-M-I-T-Y, which you probably have read, that clarifies that advanced health care directives and durable powers of attorney that come in from other states are recognized by the state of Alaska. And that's important so that there isn't confusion when there's a patient here from somewhere else. So the commission applauds your work on this and hopes to see this bill passed.
Representative Bell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 16 states.
That's what this says.
Do we have a model legislation then from one of those 16 states that is essentially that this is a copy of, or have we reinvented the wheel from our own statutes, or how did we pull together this much information if it's available in 16 other places?
I'm not sure I can answer your questions, and it looks like maybe you can, but I can say that in reading through this report, what it seems to be the intention of this National Academy on Aging Services, their intention seems to be to come up with a nationally recognized forum and to go back the other way and take a look what the states have done and see if there's one that can meet the requirements of all the states, and they're not there yet.
Linda, would you like to make some comments?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, my name is Linda Sylvester,
Thank
legislative
you.
Aide for Representative Wyrock. The model legislation that we worked with is the impetus of the bill is the Five Wishes legislation that's been adopted in 37 states. The overall comprehensive report is pulls in other end-of-life and healthcare issues and takes it and puts it into one section of statute, and that's what I believe the previous speaker was referring to. This, there is other model legislation in there. The mental health care directives, I believe that was a grassroots effort in 1996. That's an Alaska statute. The anatomical gift donation was model legislation that dates back to the 70s, as well as the living will statute goes back to the 70s. So, what I've been handed was the Five Wishes issues, the kind of the comfort things that you want your surrogates to understand about your end-of-life wishes, comes from the Uniform Healthcare Decisions Act, model legislation approved by the American Bar Association, inspired by Aging with Dignity, the organization in Florida, and Mother Teresa's attorney. That was a lot.
Well, this will be the third day of hearings we've had on this bill, and it's been tweaked quite a bit. And does anyone on the committee have any more questions? Representative?
Well, I'd just like, Madam Chair, I'd like to just clarify, the Five Wishes itself is a model, but the rewriting of pulling our stuff together, that it sounds like is not something that of pulling all of these dissimilar things together, since each state comes up with each of those statutes by themselves, and we're a model supposedly for the things that were in place, that all hasn't come together anywhere, it sounds like.
Through the chair, Representative Sisson, I think Hawaii did it. Just in my backup, what I have inherited from Representative Hudson, there are states that have done a very comprehensive approach to this. And I think that number would be the 16, because it's a pretty big job. Versus another angle of that is Alaska's had the mental health care directives, which was in 1996. The model legislation from the Uniform Healthcare Decisions Act, that got off the ground in 93. So Alaska was really cutting edge at the very beginning, because we took a comprehensive approach to mental health care. And now we're trying to expand that to include all healthcare and end-of-life issues as well.
Representative Seaton.
Yes, I'm still concerned with the issue that the nurse raised last time that we talked about here earlier. And I would like to offer a conceptual amendment on page 8, line 22, after the word physician, adding the words, if oral orders are allowed by the applicable institution. And this would, the purpose for this amendment is to get the non-physician healthcare provider out of the box of having a statutory requirement that is in violation of the institution in which they are working. If oral orders are allowed by the institution, then they would be required to follow this. But if the orders are not allowed by the institution, we are not putting the health care provider in the position of having to violate the hospital or the hospital procedures or the statute.
Linda, how do you feel about that?
Representative Wilson, can we have Dr. Wallington and Shelley Owens speak to that?
Dr. Wallington, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. I don't have any problem with adding that phrase.
Representative, through the chair, I guess I need some time to give this some thought to find out how institution is defined. I would have concerns if it might. I recognize that there are institutional issues, and then there's, and our primary concern is the pre-hospital environment. And I think your amendment wouldn't eliminate the ability to have an oral do not resuscitate order out in the field, which is my primary concern. I had thought that there might be alternatives for the hospital to be able, because the nurse spoke about her liability concerns, such as the ability to identify a physician over the phone, and I was thinking language like if the physician could be reasonably identified, or if the identity of the physician could be reasonably identified. I don't know if institution is defined within the statute.
This was, Madam Chair.
Representative
C. Yeah, this was offered as a conceptual amendment, so if we need to put hospital in there instead of institution, you know, I'd be willing for whatever goes forward. But I am concerned that, you know, we did have testimony from somebody that a nurse that served in an institution, in a hospital, that was in this position where the hospital did not allow resuscitation orders, do not resuscitate orders. And this statute says that they must comply with those. And so I don't think that it harms in any way the statute, and I'm perfectly willing to restrict it to the hospital or the institution that would not allow for those. But if they don't allow for those, I just...
Representative Wilson, we were just looking at the definitions. We think on page 28, version 8, line 19, 29, hospital. A hospital licensed, accredited, and approved under the laws of the state, rather than institution. And then we would not oppose the amendment.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make the change to my conceptual amendment to substitute the word hospital for institution.
Would you please read that again, then?
Sure. After the word physician, it would read, if oral orders are allowed by the applicable hospital.
Do I hear any objections to that amendment? Okay, so that amendment has been carried. And I would say, Linda, between now and when it gets to judiciary, you can do a little extra checking on that to see if you're comfortable. And they probably, if that needs to be adjusted, you can do that in judiciary also. Representative Hines.
Just to clarify something, if we adopt this as law and I have this for myself, and I travel, say, to Texas that does not have this, will they uphold this, or will I be bound by this? Do you know?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
A okay, if this bill becomes law and I fill out the 5 wishes, so I feel like I know what I want to happen to me, and I go to Texas, say with my family, and they have not adopted this, the 5 wishes bill. They're one of the states that has not adopted it. Would I be, what do you say, covered by? Would I be, would that hospital uphold this for me or not?
Dr. Wallington, could you respond to this?
I think if you're just asking people in the hospitals, they're going to be delighted you have direction and will be happy to follow it. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't tell you sure legally, but it would seem to me, since we have a paragraph in here saying we would accept other laws, other directives from other states, that it would depend on whether Texas has a similar phrase in their law. Perhaps you can get a legal responder to that one, though.
Thank you. Representative Gatto.
I'm pretty happy with this, and if it's okay with everyone, I'm going to move this bill unless there's somebody that has an urgent question.
Do I hear a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move committee substitute for House Bill 25, version 23-LS0137/H, Bannister 3/6/03, out of the Hess Committee with amendments and individual recommendations.
And
a zero physical note.
Okay.
You
with
sure?
No objections. So it is so moved. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'll be right back.
Let's see. Tuesday, next Tuesday, we will hear House Bill 135 and House Joint Resolution 13, and then also hear an update now, just how the department is going to reorganize and how they think that's going to fall into place. So without further ado, this meeting is adjourned at 3:45.